everyone. Welcome to episode 12 of the 2QB Experience. This is the Andrew Luck Experience, and I'm your host, Greg Smith, on the line. A fill-in co-host, no Josh tonight, but we got Sal Stefanile. How you doing, Sal?
Doing good. Yourself, Greg?
I'm doing great, man. Good to be, you know, keeping these weekly podcasts going. We also have a special guest tonight, and that's Will Carroll from FanDuel, at Injury Expert on Twitter. And as you might have guessed from that Twitter handle, he is an injury expert. And that's what we're going to talk to him about. How are you doing, Will?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. And I want to dive right in because I know your time is limited. And we're going to start with some news that is a little more topical. Injuries to players who are in the news right now. And that's Jay Ajayi and Arian Foster. Foster just signed with the Dolphins. And that kind of muddies the situation that Jay Ajayi was in as what figured to be like a feature role in that offense. But I'd like to know a little bit more about these guys from an injury standpoint. Jay Ajayi's knee, Arian Foster's Achilles tendon. You had a tweet earlier today that summarized your views on whether or not we should draft Foster. You said simply no. Do you care to expand on that a little bit and then maybe weigh in on Ajayi as well?
Yeah, you know, well, Foster's a pretty known case. You know, he's coming back from the Achilles tendon. He's had a slow recovery from that. You know, they didn't need to rush it. There's no games in April. So the question is, how is he going to look when he gets to camp? And now he'll have the chance to do that at the very start of camp. He hasn't yet passed a physical, so still waiting to see about that. The problem with Arian Foster is, you know, I hate to hang the injury-prone tag on somebody, but if you're ever going to do it, it's Arian Foster. The guy is amazingly talented. He's well-spoken. Seems like a nice guy. Unfortunately, his body just doesn't hold up to the workload of being an NFL running back. And it's not even that. It goes all the way back to college. The reason he wasn't drafted out of Tennessee, the reason he wasn't a particularly big recruit out of high school, injuries. This is something he's always had a problem with. He just simply does not stay healthy. We saw that one season where he did, and it was pretty amazing. And that's pretty much what we're hoping for. But you really can't hope for that. In a season-long league, you should not draft Arian Foster where you're going to have to draft Arian Foster to get him. There's going to be somebody who doesn't listen to this podcast, somebody who doesn't follow me on Twitter, and they're going to say, oh, Arian Foster. Well, he's in Miami. He's not going to have the full load. Let's go with him. You know, maybe they won't draft him where they would have last year in the first round, second round. But when you're talking about fifth, sixth, seventh round, that's still too early. What you're looking for from Foster is four good games. That's really all you can factor in. And you just can't do it. You just can't. Now, if he falls to you in the last round, if you're thinking of drafting, you know, a second kicker, or maybe you go for Arian Foster, yeah, absolutely. You go for Arian Foster. If you've got five good running backs and you go, you know what, I just want to buy a lottery ticket, and there's Arian Foster, yeah, absolutely. There's no reason to ever draft him. It's not like I'm banning you from drafting him. And actually, in FanDuel, you know, when you know he's healthy going into week whatever, he actually is probably going to be a pretty good value. But you know, you just simply cannot count on him, and I don't think the Dolphins are. But that takes us to Ajayi. That knee is not really so much a now problem as something of a workload problem. If you think about all the issues that we had going into this draft about what is, you know, is somebody going to have a problem now or are they going to have a problem 5 years from now? When you're talking about a Jalen Ramsey, when you're talking about a Jaylen Brown, there are just so many guys that have these small issues or even big issues in some cases, and they start falling in the draft. Same thing with Ajayi. You know, his knees are problematic. He's probably not going to have a long career. But you know what? We're not really drafting for long careers. Maybe even the Dolphins didn't draft him for a long career. Most guys don't make it through their first contract. So, yeah, you should worry about the wear and tear if you care about them as human beings. But as football players, you really shouldn't because, you know, as Arian Foster has shown, as so many players have shown, every player is one play away from missing the rest of the season.
And it sounds like, based on that sort of analysis, that maybe Arian Foster is a good thing for Jay Ajayi's fantasy stock, if only because, you know, he might last a little bit longer if Foster is carrying part of the load.
Yeah, that's very logical, but there's really no evidence to show that. The problem is that most injuries in the NFL aren't ones of a chronic nature. They don't wear down. There's some element of fatigue that we can't account for. So I think it's actually there. But when you think about injuries, when I talk about, you know, let's just stay with Arian Foster. He's had knee injuries. He's had hamstring injuries. He had the Achilles. They happen in one play. You take one bad step. Now, were they leading up to this? Yeah. But when you take a guy like an Adrian Peterson, man, that's one cut that didn't go right and his knee blows out. Reggie Wayne catches a seam in the turf and misses virtually an entire season, changes the course of a season for the Colts. So I don't think we can really count on somebody taking the workload down. When we see this over and over, it doesn't always work out. The Panthers, for years, had Stewart and D'Angelo Williams there because they said, you know what, these two guys just haven't stayed that healthy. Two guys, they don't get fatigued as much. And every year, one of them would get hurt. You split them up, and last year, Williams was great in relief for Le'Veon Bell. Jonathan Stewart on his own turned into one of the better backs in the NFL. So I wouldn't put a ton of stock in the idea that workload or you know, having a good backup really is going to matter that much to a running back.
So in terms of Ajayi, I'm just looking at his ADP right now for MFL 10 since June 15th. So about the past month, he's RB23 going off around the 60th player overall. Do you feel that is the right price for someone with like his injury concerns you just mentioned? Would you be okay drafting him at that price?
I would be okay. I think that's probably a little high just because we don't know how much they're going to split off to Arian Foster. Now, again, I can't factor Foster in for an entire season, but you know, if you're drafting him, you kind of have to, you know, maybe it gets lucky. You always have to price for the downside case and dream on the upside case. I wouldn't say that's bad, especially in this topsy-turvy draft. I think this draft, more than any in the 20-something years I've been doing this, is really strange because we're going to see a lot of different strategies. It wasn't that long ago that running back, running back, running back was the orthodoxy. You had to take at least running back in the first two rounds. And this year, I'm regularly seeing wide receiver go first. If it's Antonio Brown, I'm seeing a tight end in the middle of the first round. And oh my God, you know, somebody would have laughed. I can remember just a few years ago when I talked about drafting a quarterback in the middle of the first round, everybody was like, no, absolutely not. There's no way you can do it, and trotted out the math. This year, I think because of the way the game has changed, this one is more difficult to find an orthodox strategy. So you know, running backs are tough. Where I think a running back would have gone, like, what did you say, 60 overall? That seems reasonable, but I'm not sure it is this year.
Yeah, I think it's going to be that one year where everybody does have a different strategy, and we can't really fault anybody for the way they're going because it's just such an unusual year, like you mentioned. But no, RBRB was a dominant draft strategy not that long ago, but when we're talking about two quarterback leagues, which is our format of our choice, sometimes you'll see teams go quarterback, and on the injury front, one of the names a lot of people are worried about this year is Tony Romo, who's he's coming off of collarbone surgery in March. His prognosis was about 6-8 weeks recovery. He just turned 36. So how should two QB league players look at Tony Romo this year with his injury and age?
The age I don't think factors that much into his collarbone. This isn't Grandma Nell who fell and broke her hip. This is Tony Romo. He's in good shape. He's not that old. He doesn't have any bone conditions that we know of. He just falls wrong. I mean, every single time Tony Romo has had this injury, which is three now, it's because he stuck his arm out and tried to catch himself as he fell. It's instinct. It's hard not to do it. I was just talking to an NBA executive yesterday about this, and he was like, we see all these guys. Larry Nance just broke his hand. LeBron James in the finals fell and kind of gave him his arm a shock. It's instinct. So I can't really fault him for it, but that's why it happens. So as long as he doesn't do that, he should be fine. They plated it. 6 to 8 weeks is more than enough time for this to come back. If you follow racing, and it happened in Fort Worth. Joseph Newgarden, driver for Ed Carpenter Racing in IndyCar, had one of the ugliest wrecks you're ever going to see. And he ended up with a broken collarbone. He has 12 screws and two plates that are holding together his collarbone. He came back and drove 2 weeks later. An IndyCar. This is insane. So if he can do that in 2 weeks, I think Tony Romo can do it in 8. And let's remember, it's not really 8 because, again, there's no way they're going to build a bubble around him inside the Star, that new facility that Dallas is going to have. He's not going to take contact. He's probably not going to play much in the preseason. So he's going to have an extended period of time for that plate to set, for him to get comfortable with it. I don't think he's going to have any problems with it.
Yeah, another player I've expected to kind of see in a bubble based upon, you know, his injury concerns is Sammy Watkins with his broken foot. Now, he's such a young player that it makes a lot of sense for the Bills to be very cautious with him. What's the prognosis on Watkins? Do you expect him to be ready for week one? And is he worth the draft price where we're seeing him go in that, like, second or third round of drafts?
Yeah, on both, I think he's going to be fine. I think, you know, it really comes down to how much you like that Buffalo offense. With Watkins going to be out for a little bit, that puts more on LeSean McCoy. McCoy wasn't what everybody hoped for last year, but I'm not sure that's his fault. The quarterback situation was better, and, you know, is Taylor going to take this challenge to not being re-signed long-term? Is he going to take that well? Is he not going to respond well? We just don't know. And I think all that is going to really factor into Sammy Watkins. But the foot shouldn't. What he has is a Jones fracture, which is a fracture of the outside bone in his foot, the fifth metatarsal. It's the same exact thing we saw with Dez Bryant, same exact thing we saw with Julio Jones, Ahmad Bradshaw, Julian Edelman. It's unfortunately becoming a more and more common injury. And because of that, we've seen it more and more. Now, last year, Dez Bryant, they kind of did things backwards. Normally, they'll go in and put a screw in it. And almost everyone in the NFL that's had that procedure has it come loose. I can remember talking to Ahmad Bradshaw when he was here. He was like, you feel it. The screw is loose. And you know, I've been accused of having a screw loose a lot of times, but I've never actually felt one in my body, let alone my foot, as I'm running around come loose. That can't be comfortable. So once they do that, then they take a piece of bone from your hip and kind of do a bone graft. It's called a bone plug. They put that in. With Dez Bryant, they did it backwards. They went with a bone plug first for no apparent reason. I'm sure the surgeon had a reason, but they tried to cover up a lot of things about it. He came back in the normal period of time, but you know what? Had the same problem. So they went and put the screw in. So now, does the screw come loose? We don't know. Dez Bryant's a special case to begin with. With Watkins, yeah, the screw could come loose, and yeah, he could have that problem, but we usually don't see it in that first year. Julio Jones had to have the bone plug. Ahmad Bradshaw had to have the screw replaced once. Then he had to have the bone plug. Somewhere down the lines, Watkins will have a problem, but I don't think we should really factor that in. Same with Edelman. You know, he's coming back from the same thing. I just really don't think we can factor that in, even though it's kind of a known. It's one of those things that down the line, maybe they're doing things better, or maybe we see it. And it's just one of those things that's just going to happen, and we take it, and we hope we drafted well and have good backups. But with Watkins, I'm fairly comfortable with his valuation. What I'm not comfortable with is how I value the entire Buffalo offense.
So are you saying that the eventual secondary procedure that might need to happen, that from player to player, it can just vary so wildly that we have no real idea of, you know, when it's going to crop up for Watkins if it does?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the hope is that it doesn't crop up, of course. The second is that it crops up somewhere down the line and they're able to keep it going. And he can play with a little bit of discomfort, and they go back in there in the off season. That's always what you hope to do, is get a guy through the season. But it's just one of those things. You're rolling the dice a little bit, but it's not like an Arian Foster where you're just waiting for something to go wrong. This is something that is likely to happen, but it's so absolutely unpredictable. I don't even think we can factor it in.
All right, well, heading back to the quarterback position, we saw Joe Flacco last season miss the second half with his ACL. His first 7 seasons in the league, he played 16 games in a row. How are we viewing Flacco heading into the season with his injury?
You know, Flacco's an interesting case. You know, he is so healthy. One of the things we look at with ACLs is whether or not the player is athletic. And this is always difficult for me because he's an NFL quarterback. Of course, he's athletic. He's one of the elite athletes out there.
He's elite.
And Flacco in the same thing.
It's official.
You start that whole thing.
We'll edit that part out.
Exactly. But it's one of those situations where normally athletic players are able to come back from it. The problem is not the physical. It's not even the rehab. It tends to be the confidence. Now, from day one, Adrian Peterson was just ready to go. He was so convinced in his own athletic ability that I think from the time he hopped off the surgeon's table, he probably could have played. Not advisable. But I can remember talking to Jim Andrews in late January of that year. Peterson had had the surgery on New Year's Eve. And by late January, I asked Jim, I was like, how's he doing? And he goes, he's pretty much ahead of schedule. And I was like, it's been a month. How is he even on schedule? But he was. He was actually two sections ahead in the rehab at that point, I later learned. So with Flacco, you don't think of him as being this kind of super confident athlete, but he is. If you think back to that NFL Super Bowl 50 MVP thing where they brought out all the old MVPs, you can see some of the older guys, especially guys wobbling out on their two knee replacements. And Joe Flacco, obviously a much younger guy than some of them, came striding out and looked great. And I actually had forgotten until afterwards that he had just had ACL surgery. He was wearing a very small brace under his suit. He was having no problems then. So things have looked good very early on. Checking in on him since, he's been ahead of schedule every step of the way. He's going to be very, very normal. Walking into camp 8 to 9 months after the injury, I don't think he's going to have any problems.
You know, another player we've seen or saw last season with a torn ACL was Jamaal Charles. And, him and Le'Veon Bell are both these kind of unknown running back quantities at this point because of these injuries they're coming off of. Now, with Le'Veon, it was a torn MCL and PCL. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between those injuries and why that might lead to you having more confidence in one player versus the other?
Yeah, I'll start with Le'Veon Bell because this is the unusual one. We're so used to ACL injuries, and we start talking about isolated ACL injuries or triad injuries where there's ACL, MCL, and meniscus involvement. And it's a little tougher to come back from, but then again, Adrian Peterson and Wes Welker came back from the triad even quicker than Adrian Peterson. And nobody's like, oh, look at Wes Welker. He's a physical freak. So in that situation, an ACL injury is pretty standard. We understand them. We know what the rehab process is like. And in Jamaal Charles's case, we've got a perfect comp. Jamaal Charles, he did this before. He came back pretty darn well. He had the same surgeon. Everything's the same. So there's almost no reason to think the return is not going to be the same. Le'Veon Bell, on the other hand, has an injury we almost never see, which is an MCL-PCL combo. There was some meniscal involvement. There are a couple other structures that were involved that were secondary to it. The MCL, which is on the inside of the knee, is actually normally not repaired, but it was in this case. It was actually fully reconstructed because they were worried about the stability of the knee. The PCL in the back of the knee is one we just normally don't see in a football context. We've seen some. We saw Breshad Perriman last year, and he's had continual problems. We saw Andre Johnson a couple of years ago, though his was not fully ruptured. Guys just don't come back from this as well. There's not as many cases. The rehab isn't quite as standardized. It's just not as much of a known. So to me, this is very much a binary injury. Now, if he comes into camp and in the first day runs around and looks awesome, he's probably going to be awesome. But I don't know that sitting here in the middle of July. Everything we've seen from him has been nice, but it hasn't been telling. We've seen him running, but he's not cutting. We've seen him jumping up. He was playing basketball and dunking. And I was like, good, that's not what stresses
not
out
football.
The PCL. What I'd like to see you do is run and stop. That's what's going to stress that knee. So until we see that, we don't know. Once we see that, we should know. So if you're one of these crazy people that drafts super early before training camp has even started, it's an absolute unknown. By the time we get to, even a preseason game, we're going to know very well whether Le'Veon Bell's the back he was or not, whether he's worthy of a first-round pick or not. At this point, there's absolutely no way I could pick him in the first round. Would I take a gamble in the second round? Maybe. Reports have been positive. But, you know, again, once we see him, we'll know everything we need to know.
One offense a lot of fantasy analysts have been trying to decipher this offseason is the Bengals, with the loss of Marvin Jones to Detroit, Andy Dalton coming back from a thumb injury. But the big name we want to focus on right now is Tyler Eifert, with the last news coming out saying he might not be ready to start the season. Is that something that you also feel the same with? Do you think he'll be back to start the season?
Yeah, the timing's a little odd. You know, people are complaining that he waited, but they were hoping he was going to be able to avoid surgery. And if you can avoid surgery, you do. Too many times we've seen infections and other things. You always avoid surgery if possible. And look, if it had healed up without the need for surgery, hey, he would have been great. Now, yeah, week one's in question. I think he's going to be able to make it back. He's been a good healer. This isn't that complex a procedure that he had. But, you know, if you have to hold him out that extra week to have him ready for the other 15 games, you do it. It's the smart play. They played without him before. The timing's a little rough. He's going to take some heat from the fans, but it was the smart medical decision, and it was largely guided by the doctors.
You know, another player who had a really big year last season and now is, you know, being severely discounted because of his injuries, Thomas Rawls. He broke his ankle. He had some ligament damage in there. Is the hate on Thomas Rawls from a fantasy perspective justified based on these injuries? We know that the Seahawks drafted a couple other running backs. What do you expect from Rawls? Do you think he's going to be fine? Do you think we need to be worried? Give us your thoughts.
The real question is, does the ankle take away his margin for error? You know, we don't know how good Thomas Rawls really is. He looked pretty good, but, you know, he certainly wasn't Marshawn Lynch, who is. In any valid NFL offense, there's a minimum standard. And if you put that minimum standard in there, into the right offense in the right situation, they're going to look a lot better. I mean, if you put me behind the Dallas Cowboys offensive line, I'm probably not going to look that – well, yeah, I am. I'm going to look that bad. Bad example. But, you know, if you take any minimum standard, somebody who can make a 53-man roster – They're going to look to a certain level. We just don't know what the difference is. If Marshawn Lynch is 100, is Thomas Rawls a 90? Is he an 80? With this ankle injury, if he loses 5, does that make him a 75, which probably puts him right on the edge of being a backup? We just don't know. And that unknown scares me. You know, I wouldn't take the risk of drafting him because I don't think his ceiling is that high. I think Thomas Rawls is a good to not, you know, maybe he's on the edge of great at the complete best case scenario, but he's always going to lose carries to Russell Wilson. It's an offense that likes to pass. Certainly don't give a lot of goal line touches. So I just can't see Rawls being somebody I'd pick as a running back one, maybe down into the running back two, once I've seen that he's cutting well. But I just worry too much that this is going to be something that takes away his margin for it. Same with Deion Lewis. You know, Deion Lewis is a guy who's been cut by I don't know how many teams, and then he gets into the right offense and the right situation, and he looked like a world beater. But can he come back from an ACL? Everybody should be able to come back from an ACL. Again, minimum level of athleticism at the NFL level. But I don't know how much of a margin of error he has. This is a guy who's been cut time and time again.
Sticking with the Seahawks offense, do you feel more comfortable with Jimmy Graham coming back from his torn patellar tendon than you do from with Thomas Rawls' injury?
No, not at all. With Jimmy Graham, you can't do it. I'm feeling a little bit better about it than I did when it first happened, and largely because of Victor Cruz. The reports on Victor Cruz have been relatively positive, which would mean somebody came back from this injury. Prior to that, it's really nobody. Guys have come back and played, but they haven't come back and played well. So I just have no confidence whatsoever. Maybe Jimmy Graham comes back and he's phenomenal. If so, he's the first and he's great. Maybe he just has that much athletic ability. Maybe 75% of Jimmy Graham is still good enough to be a good NFL tight end, but nobody's ever done it. What you're looking at this year with Jimmy Graham is drafting Victor Cruz last year. That's the same kind of hope. You're hearing the positive reports. You're hoping he comes back. You know what he did in the past. but there's just no evidence to show that he can come back.
We're talking with Will Carroll here from FanDuel, at Injury Expert on Twitter, and I got a couple more questions for you, Will, before we let you go. The first is more of a general one. Sal mentioned earlier that we do focus on the two-quarterback format. In terms of quarterbacks as different types of commodities, you know, some people like to boil fantasy down into, you know, I have a rushing quarterback or I have a pocket passer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see, like, a difference between the two from an injury perspective, or are all these guys subject to the same injuries? Because, like you said, every play is different. Every, you know, hit could be the one hit that
yeah.
puts somebody on the shelf.
Yeah, and I think what you have to do is take a look at a guy like Andrew Luck. And I know we're going to talk about him later, but he's something of a hybrid. You know, when you talk about a Russell Wilson who's not that big, but he's solidly built, or you take a look at a guy like Robert Griffin, who's actually pretty much bigger than a lot of people think, though he looks slight, or a Johnny Manziel, who people were just convinced couldn't last in the NFL, and it turns out it was his liver, not his legs. there's a lot of situations, but what it really boils down to is how much is your quarterback getting hit? If he's getting hit in the pocket, that's bad. If he's getting hit out in the field, that's bad. If he gets hit when he's running, that you just don't want your quarterback getting hit. Maybe the only exception is Cam Newton, because he's just that big. He's not built like a running back. He's built like a truck. And you know, if everybody was built like him, I don't think we'd be worried about it. If everybody was as mobile as him and wouldn't get hit as much, he's the only guy I've ever seen that gets hit as solidly as he does and shows no consequences. I thought Andrew Luck was that guy, but you could see the last couple of years he was getting hit so much on virtually every play that he was really wearing down at the end of the season. If they can just reduce some of those hits on him, I think he's going to come back without a problem. But I don't think there's one specific type. I think what it comes down to, and now that we have these stats, whether it's Pro Football Focus or any other number of things, the number of hits a quarterback takes. If you're watching football, you kind of know. How often is that guy not just getting hit, but getting blowed up? If you can remember a big, nasty hit, that's probably a pretty big negative. And if you can remember a number of them, then you probably want to stay away from him, or at least factor in that risk. Same with older quarterbacks. Older quarterbacks, there's a survivor effect, but there are more injuries. Drew Brees had the weirdest injury last year. He had a bruised rotator cuff. It's nearly impossible to do. But yeah, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it on the turf in New Orleans in the NFL. So I don't think there's a specific type. I think it comes down to how clean is his uniform at the end of the day.
Well, you mentioned Andrew Luck there. He is the spotlight quarterback for our offense. And in two quarterback leagues last year, he was being drafted neck and neck with Aaron Rodgers as like the first player taken in two quarterback leagues. Now, the injury concerns from last year now have dropped him into like mid-first, second-round range. From a two quarterback perspective, what's his outlook going into the season?
I think it has to be positive, because you have to take a look at what he did last year from a physical perspective and say, you know what, the shoulder we know now isn't or wasn't healthy, but that now it is. It came back. He didn't have a problem with that. The kidney laceration, that's one of those things. You know, it's not just that he gets hit a lot. He got hit just wrong in the worst possible way, because he was twisted and bent over, and he hit him right in the right spot, and yeah, his rib guard was pulled up. I wish he had a better rib guard. I wish every quarterback had a better rib guard. It was dumb luck, and bad dumb luck at that. So we take the kidney, and we toss that out. We take the shoulder, and we say, are we a little concerned about this? Is there some labrum damage in there? Yeah, we're worried about that, but we're worried about that down the line. You know, worst case scenario is he's Drew Brees. Ooh, I'll take that. So with him, it's really coming down to, do you believe in the changes that the Colts have made? Do you believe that the offensive changes, the new coordinator, the fact that Philbin's kind of drawing up these line coverage, that they drafted all these guys? It kind of depends on how much you believe in those guys and how much you believe in the concept the Colts have in protecting him. They've got offensive weapons, but they've always had those. They've got a blocking running back in Frank Gore, but they had that last year. I'm not completely bought in on this. I think Andrew Luck is going to be significantly better than he was last year. And if they can just keep him from getting hit less than 100 times, I think he'll have a phenomenal year. And I think he'll be a top five quarterback. He's got all the talent. He's an odd dude. And I mean that in a very nice way. I don't think the money that he just got is going to affect him in the least. Some guys think they have to live up to it. Some guys get comfortable. I don't honestly think that Andrew's going to even notice. So I think he's going to be out there. He's a guy that doesn't have a lot of life outside. He reads a lot of books and he watches a lot of film and wants to play a lot of football. And I think he's going to have every chance of that this year. I think last year was going to, I think it's last year that we're going to look at as the aberration.
Great stuff, Will. Hey, we really want to thank you for your time coming on our little podcast here. And any parting thoughts before you go?
No. I think we covered a lot of guys, and hopefully people will read my work this year. And unfortunately, we're going to have a lot of injuries this year. The hope is that it's not your players.
Yeah, we all hope that for sure. Well, thanks again, Will. Appreciate your time, and be sure to follow him on Twitter at @InjuryExpert. Check out his work on FanDuel. And take care, Will.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Will.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Well, that was awesome. We have a lot more to get to here with Andrew Luck, though, Sal. Let's start off with the quarterback finish game. We're going to predict where Luck ranks in terms of total points for 2016 and the points per game for 2016 among all quarterbacks. I'll go first here, if only because I have Luck ranked as my QB1, so I'm going to go ahead and say that I think he finishes 2016 as the QB1 in total points. Where are you at?
I'm going to take the same route as you and go with my rank, because I have him at number 4. I think he'll finish this season as a top 4 fantasy quarterback.
And you can find our rankings at 2QBs.com, so if you want to see who Sal has above Luck, I'll tease that in that way. How about in points per game? Do you think – let me rephrase. Is Luck's ranking for you at number 4 partially because of injury risk? Do you think maybe he has the chance to finish better in terms of points per game in 2016?
I think he can finish anywhere from fantasy QB1 to fantasy QB5. It just that top elite tier can kind of be interchangeable for me. You know, Newton, Rodgers, Wilson, Luck, I kind of see them all having the possibility to finish the season as QB1. And if Andrew Luck does finish the season playing all 16 games, I can definitely see him being QB1 in total points, QB1 in points per game. I'm just putting him at 4 because I just think Newton, Rodgers, and Wilson have a better chance of making that happen. So that's why I'm sticking with the QB4 ranking for Luck. But I guess I think either one of those guys are a fine option for QB1.
Yep, I'll keep Luck at QB1 in points per game as well. I mean, this is kind of a boring one, if only because we both have him ranked so high. But I do want to talk a little bit about that notion that, you know, Luck went from being the QB1 in ADP last year to now being the QB3 or QB4, depending upon where you look. Do you think the hate has gone too far, not far enough? Do you think it's just right? I mean, it sounds like you ranking him at 4 is pretty in line with ADP. So it sounds like you think it's a pretty fair reaction to his 2015 season.
Yeah, I think it's a fair reaction. He's QB3 in ADP right now. He's going at 14.9 overall, just 2 picks ahead of Russell Wilson. Like Newton, Rodgers, Luck, Wilson, those make up top 4 in ADP. They're all being taken in the first 2 rounds, so I don't think the hate has gone too far. I think last year he was going 101 with Aaron Rodgers. That's because he was coming off that monster 2014 season. He was fully healthy. Everybody thought he would take the leap from QB2 to QB1, which might not seem like a big jump, but it could be when you're talking about fantasy, just because of how many different quarterbacks tend to be the fantasy QB1s each season. So I think if you mentioned like the hate on Luck, I would say it's just right at this moment. If we saw him go below Wilson, like maybe after Breeze or Roethlisberger in round 3 and 4, then I think it might have been too reactionary. But it seems like we have a pretty smart fantasy drafting crowd this year.
Yeah, I think it's totally fair to have him, in that QB4, QB3, even QB5. I think if you want to pick, one of the Brady, Roethlisberger tier, like somebody, or even Breeze, if you want to put Breeze above Andrew Luck, I can't fault you for that. For me, I just look at Luck and I see a guy who is really shaping up to have just a ton of volume yet again. Like, I don't think that Colts defense has gotten a whole lot better. I hate their running back core, which leads me to believe that they're probably just going to pass a ton. And he is a very good quarterback. And that's part of what's propped up Drew Brees for so many seasons, is the fact that he's very good and they let him pass a ton. I think we're going to see the exact same thing with Luck this season. And Will Carroll just made that same comparison between the two. So I think that's the sort of situation we're looking at. And that's why I still have Luck at QB1. I think that we are reacting a little bit too much to the injury season last year. I think if he had been healthy with those weapons and with his lack of running game, that he very well would have been right there with Cam and Russell Wilson down the stretch. I understand ranking those other guys higher if you perceive them as safer, but I'm going to bank on the volume that I expect the Colts to get, and that's why I have him ranked as high as I do.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of virtual ink spilled this offseason trying to determine who's going to be the breakout receiver in that offense between Dante Moncrief and Philip Dorsett. But then with Andrew Luck, he gets to throw to all those guys. He gets to throw to Moncrief, Hilton, Dorsett, you know, Frank Gore's in there, Josh Ferguson, Dwayne Allen. So from a fantasy standpoint, you don't have to choose between the receivers. You get Andrew Luck, who gets to throw to all those guys, which kind of makes him an appealing option in two quarterback leagues this year, just the amount of offensive wealth he has at his disposal.
Yeah, and it's actually to the point where I think all of those guys are probably worth gambling on if you're looking for a quote-unquote breakout. Like, I think Hilton's going to be good. I think Moncrief's going to be good. I think Dwayne Allen is going to be good. I love that they lost Kobe Fleener for the sake of those other receivers. Philip Dorsett going later is a nice value right now. There's just a lot to like about that passing game, and I think that, you know, Frank Gore, you know, if he stays on the field, should be fine. Like, he'll deliver Frank Gore numbers, but I have a feeling they're going to really make their bones passing the ball.
And we saw, you know, I was going to say, just so people trying to figure out Andrew Luck's injury, how he's going to perform. Now, when he came back after those two games he missed early in the season, and he finished off the season playing from week 6 to week 9, he was a QB1 in 4 out of his 5 games. I think some people might forget that just because of the injury concerns and how much he didn't play last year. But this is a quarterback in his career who went from the fantasy QB9 his rookie year to the QB4 the next year, to the QB2 the year after that. Like, he's been on that projection to be an elite fantasy QB1 his whole career. And I think we might forget that just because of how few games he played last year.
Yep. And even in those games, he never had one where he finished below quarterback 24. You know, 6 of his 7 games, he was a top 20 QB. And in half of those, 3 of those games, like you said, he was a QB1. So, and that's the big takeaway for me, is that Luck is very good. And it really comes down to preference in terms of how you rank him versus those other top options, because we know all those guys are really good. And I think that I don't necessarily want to draft Andrew Luck at 1.01 in my two quarterback leagues. But, you know, if I had to choose, if I was forced to pick a quarterback, you know, in the first round and all of them were available, he's the guy I'd go with. It doesn't really jive with my drafting strategy per se, as kind of a late round QB zealot, but I think that all those guys have value. I think that they're all kind of interchangeable, and I think that you agree on that.
Oh, yeah, exactly. If we're just talking about price, it's very easy to make the case to bypass Andrew Luck and just wait later on and take a Philip Rivers in the mid-round, or even, like, you know, we mentioned Tony Romo earlier in the late rounds. Whatever way you feel like building your roster around the quarterback position, it's pretty much, you know, pick and choose what you like.
Yeah. Do you have anything else on Andrew Luck before we move on here, Sal?
No, I think it might. He's not going to be in the conversation this year as the overall QB1 like he was last year with Rodgers. But if you're on the clock and you're wondering if you should take Andrew Luck in the first, you know, 2 rounds, don't be scared off by the injury talk. I feel like we heard Will Carroll mention it earlier. Andrew Luck is in line to just have a historical fantasy season, and if you're willing to take a quarterback early, I think you should consider Luck.
All right, with that said, let's move into some new stuff that we've got at 2QBs.com. Things are really ramping up here in the offseason. The Scott Fishbowl is basically wrapped up at this point, but now that it's done, you can see some legit ADP for all the different leagues that are finished or almost finished. The ADP data is available at 2QBs.com, and that's a really good barometer for where, you know, 2QB ADP could be. I mean, we know that there are some differences in terms of running back and tight end scoring there, but if you're looking at, you know, quarterbacks relative to each other or any other position relative to itself, you get a lot of good information there in terms of, you know, where the fantasy community and the experts at large kind of view these quarterbacks. Is there anything in the ADP, Sal, that has really jumped out at you, guys that, you know, surprisingly went lower or higher than you expected?
Well, I would say for people that are in deep two quarterback or super flex leagues to look at the ADP and just see how many quarterbacks have been drafted so far. The last time I checked, there was 51 legitimate quarterbacks plus Uncle Rico. I'm not sure if Uncle Rico is going to be in your player database, but if he is, he has an ADP higher than Scott Tolzien, for example. But it's been interesting to see where like the QB3 tier specifically is being drafted. And we all know how much of an influence the news blurbs have, and RotoWorld and Adam Schefter, and Trevor Siemian has been in the news lately.
I was going to say, how about the influence that you've had, Sal, with your Trevor Siemian piece?
I'm not going to take much credit because I just wrote one article about the guy, and then that was it. But it has been interesting to see that he's kind of been like that no-name quarterback a lot of people in the SFB 480 have kind of paid attention to, just because apparently he might have a chance at winning the starting job. I'm not sure if that has more to do with his talent or more to do with the fact that he's going up against Mark Sanchez and a rookie in Paxton Lynch. But he's definitely been a name to keep an eye on. If your drafts are one of those really early ones and you're looking for a flyer of a guy who is a backup quarterback right now who might start in this later in the season, he seems to be the player a lot of guys are targeting right now.
Yeah, the other guy that I like, and it's another player that you clued me into, Sal, is Chase Daniel on the Eagles. The reports coming out of Philly are that Carson Wentz is going to redshirt the entire 2016 season. And while I don't 100% believe that, it does kind of make sense from a strategic standpoint. If you're the Eagles, like, you might as well be bad for another year while you let Wentz improve. And, if we know that Bradford is the starter, we also know that Bradford isn't that good. So that I can envision a scenario where either Bradford gets hurt or benched in favor of Chase Daniel. And he was essentially free in the Scott Fishbowl. He's another guy that if you're in a D2 QB league, you can target.
I definitely agree with that. And for anybody out there that wants to know more about Trevor Siemian or Chase Daniel, we have a couple of QB profiles on both those quarterbacks on our site, so you can check those out.
Yep. The last piece of SFB content I want to promote are some posts from a new contributor to the site, Josh Hornsby, Fantasy ADHD on Twitter. He's really dove deep with some killer charts looking at the first couple days of Scott Fishbowl data. Very cool stuff. You should check that out. The next piece we want to talk about is one by Joshua Lake, my normal co-host here, and he was talking about the worth of a QB2. And this is a really interesting spot for two quarterback fantasy, especially this year because quarterback ADP has been so suppressed. Sal, what did you think of Josh's piece, and are there any QB2s that really stand out to you as guys that you want to target in your drafts this year?
I thought Josh did a great job showing us just like the historical trends of the quarterback two position. I mean, for me, when I'm drafting a two quarterback league, the QB1 doesn't matter a whole lot in terms of drafting an ADP, because the top 12 quarterbacks are top 12 quarterbacks. Most people can agree on them. It's at QB2 when we start to diversify our stock in our second quarterback and try and figure out when to take them, who to take them, how do they fit in with our roster construction. So it's been interesting to see the trends over there, just how much later the quarterbacks have been going in two quarterback leagues. But like, it's just, we say this every year, quarterback is deep, but this year it just seems even more ridiculously deep than it has in past years. You're getting guys like Philip Rivers, Eli Manning, James Winston, Tony Romo's going at 81 overall, basically. Same with Matthew Stafford. I thought Tyrod Taylor was going to be heavily drafted after his year last year. He's going in like pick 82. Joe Flacco. I could list off the whole QB2 ADP tier and just be like, oh wow, how is that guy going so late? So it all depends how my roster and draft is going in, like, say, the first six or eight rounds, depending on when I'm going to take quarterback. But I could realistically see myself taking my QB2 in round 4 and round 6 and round 8, round 10. It already depends who's left on the board at that point.
Yeah, the uncertainty in that kind of middle tier of quarterbacks is just more prevalent this season than anything else. One thing that isn't uncertain is the value of Russell Wilson. He's one of those guys like Andrew Luck who we kind of have pegged as a no doubt QB or top 5 QB this year. And Anthony Amico just did an awesome profile on Russell Wilson. Definitely check that out. Next up, Sal, I want to talk to you about your piece recently about how to replace Tom Brady in two quarterback leagues. You don't need to spoil the piece necessarily, but can you give folks an idea of what the piece is about and what you're looking for in someone to fill in for Brady in those early weeks?
Yeah, but like earlier in the offseason, I did a QB profile on Jimmy Garoppolo, the backup in New England, who now looks to be the starter for the first 4 weeks since Tom Brady has decided to forego his appeal of his four-game suspension. And at the time, I wasn't really a big fan of Jimmy based on his matchups for the first 4 weeks, but at the time, there was a whole lot of information to base my decision off of, other than going off of what happened last year. You know, one of my favorite fantasy football articles every season is Pat Thorman's strength of schedule analysis that he puts up for Pro Football Focus Fantasy, where he dives deep into quarterback matchups every year. And I wanted to see what quarterback or what quarterback pairings I could put together with Tom Brady as replacement for the first 4 weeks of the season. And I was able to put a few together based on their cost. So if anybody out there wants to know who I would be looking to target as to pair up with Tom Brady as his replacement for the first 4 weeks, you'll be able to get a few different combinations in that article.
The last piece we want to touch on that's new at the site is an Aaron Rodgers profile by Ben Cummins, and one more guy who's just in that kind of no-brainer top five category. Where do you stand on Rodgers, Sal? I mean, we know you have Andrew Luck at QB4. Is Rodgers number one, number two, number three, and how do you compare him to the other guys in that top tier?
Yeah, like right now I have him ranked at QB1 overall. That's just because I have to put somebody at QB1. I can't put a four-way tie because then they'll just screw up all the rankings for us. But I see Aaron Rodgers as somebody who can come back and be the fantasy QB1. No, he has that upside in him, and it looks like he's going to be with a pretty decent offense around him again, like he usually is. And we've seen in the past just like how immense that upside is from Aaron Rodgers. And like he has the QB1 potential in him, just like Andrew Luck does, just like Russell Wilson does, just like Cam Newton does. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma this year in two quarterback leagues. Like, do you take quarterback first overall? And if you do, which one of those four are you taking?
Yeah, the biggest selling point for me with Rodgers is the fact that he gives you more elite weeks, more top 10 weeks than anyone else. If you look at the stats from the past 4 years, and you look at the percentage of times a quarterback has finished in the top 10, Rodgers is far and away the best of the current quarterbacks who are available. 57.9% of the time over the past 4 years, Rodgers has delivered a top 10 performance each week. The next closest is Peyton Manning over those 4 years with 55.2%. Now, that does factor in Peyton Manning's, kind of crappy year last year. But Manning's gone. So now you're comparing Aaron Rodgers to the guy who's third on the list. And, oh, surprise, it's Andrew Luck, 52.7% of the time. Like, these guys deliver a lot of top 10 weeks relative to the other quarterbacks. And that elite play, I think, is what you do want out of your first round quarterbacks if you're going to go that route in a 2 QB league. So I really can't argue with him as QB1. I think that Rodgers is awesome, and he deserves to be in that conversation basically every season that he's healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just looking at his QB stat card up on the site, and two of the past four seasons, his average weekly finish was 9.9 in 2012 and 9.3 in 2014, which basically meant he was a QB1 every week. No, that's the type of return you want to get on your first round pick investment.
Yeah, absolutely. That mitigating that risk on a quarterback in the early rounds is really crucial. Anything else new with the site or upcoming on the site that you want to plug here, Sal, before we move on?
It seems like we hit on everything that was new. Like we mentioned, we had some great guest content for the SFB. TJ Hernandez from 4for4 put up a recap of his conference. On the lookout on the horizon, we're going to have a new update to Joe Siniscalchi's quarterback big board. So if you're into quarterback tiering, that's going to be one to watch out for. It's always in depth. And we're getting in the final stages of putting up some two quarterback auction content, which I know a lot of two QBs out there have been craving lately.
Yep, I do a super flex auction every year, so I can't wait for that stuff myself. With that said, let's get into some of the Twitter questions, and we're going to start off with one that's very important. This is from Nathan Powell, at NPowellFF on Twitter. Sal, you're the expert. You're from Canada. Is maple syrup a sandwich?
I don't know why or how Nathan even came up with this question. I mean, at least when you see these questions on Twitter, the food in question has bread involved. Like, this is just a condiment. So, Nathan, I'm going to answer your question just because I like you, but the answer is no.
Not a sandwich. Definitive.
I'm going to go 100% on the board with that answer.
All right. The next one is from George Criticos at RotoHack. He says, what is your favorite Swayze character, movie, and line?
All right. I know my answers, and I'm going to take up probably the next 45 minutes of this podcast in detail. So before I take up the time, Greg, I'm going to let you answer this one.
Bodhi, Point Break, Back Off War Child. Put a stamp on it.
You can't go wrong with any of those answers, but the thing is, you are wrong, Greg.
Oh, no.
The answer is Dalton, Roadhouse, and Have You Ever Seen a Better Pair of Attitudes? That last line goes underrated when it comes to the Patrick Swayze quote canon, and I think the best part of that quote is you listen to that line in that movie, and you think it's one of those words that was dubbed in for another word because it was not safe for children's ears, and that word I'm talking about is attitudes, but that real word was really in the script. Like, somebody wrote that line specifically for that movie, and that's what makes that line the best Patrick Swayze line. And it wasn't even said by Patrick Swayze, so you know how much respect I'm giving it.
Just as a sidebar, do you have any other favorite, like, TV edits on, the dirty words in movies? Because I've got a couple.
Not off the top of my head, but I'd love to hear yours.
So, The Usual Suspects, which is probably my favorite movie of all time. If you watched that one on TV in, like, the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, there's a scene where they're in the lineup room and they're made to repeat a line. And that line is, give me the fucking keys, you motherfucking cocksucker. And it becomes, give me the keys, fairy godmother. And that's probably my favorite. But there's some other good ones. Ferris Bueller's got a couple, like, I'm trying to think of some other ones. Big Lebowski's got a few as well.
I think the most famous one, at least in our generation, is Snakes on the Plane.
And what's that one?
I think the line is, like, get these motherfucking snakes off these motherfucking plane. But every single, like, depends what channel you're watching the movie on, is going to dub that word for something completely hilarious.
Just, I know you're such a Swayze buff, Sal. While we're on this topic, what's your least favorite Swayze movie?
I don't have a least favorite Swayze movie, Greg. They're all tied for first.
They're all tied for first. Okay. I'm clearly a Point Break guy. You're a Roadhouse guy. Roadhouse is my number two, but yeah, I also love Swayze movies. Next question comes from at Fantasy Seer. He says, have you ever seen a jankier QB situation than my Cutler, Bridgewater, Gabbert, Goff combination in SFB 480?
I mean, first, I just want to give him props for using the word jankier, because that's not one you tend to hear too often not only in the fantasy community, but just like in real life. I don't think anybody I hang out has ever said the word jankier or janky. So just props for using that word. But to answer that question, I'm sure I have. Like, I've seen a lot of bad quarterbacks drafted in two quarterback leagues. I've drafted a lot of bad quarterback stables
Get
myself.
Out of here.
So I mean, you're talking to Alex Smith's number one fan, Greg. So I think you can kind of figure out what my quarterback depth charts have been in the past. But in specifically for these four quarterbacks, I mean, it really is kind of just a bunch of hope and prayer types. You know, Cutler, I would be more comfortable as my quarterback two, not my quarterback one. I think Goff, Blaine Gabbert, Jared Goff are all more like low-end QB three. I mean, like, high-end QB3s, low-end QB2 types. So it's going to be a lot of matchup streaming. And this might be one of those few instances in the SFB 480 where you might consider starting non-quarterback in your flex spot, kind of depending on how the rest of your roster looks like and the matchups for that week.
Yeah, the one thing I'll say for the Sears lineup here is that at least he got four guys, right? You just have that one extra dude to play the matchups with and, you know, one extra lottery ticket. And I actually have drafted Blaine Gabbert a ton this season. I'm not really a Cutler, Bridgewater, or Goff guy, but any one of these guys could break out to some extent. We've seen Cutler have good years before. Bridgewater had a lot of promise when he came into the league. He could finally deliver on that, you know, now that he has some more weapons. I don't necessarily buy that, but, you know, you can talk yourself into these different narratives that would prop up a team like this. Now, if I only had three of them, then I have to hit on that many more of those narratives, right? But if I have four of them, then I only have to hit on, you know, two out of four, and that would make me feel a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about his quarterback depth chart is he, based on the four guys, he probably didn't have to spend a whole lot drafting them.
Yeah, I mean, that probably depends on his league, you know, how fast the quarterbacks went in that division of the SFB. I know that there were some divisions where the quarterbacks just got picked clean real fast. My division was nothing like that, where people were really waiting on the position, and you could get those guys in later rounds. But yeah, that makes a big difference.
There's another one. I'll go with Fantasy Seer just because we just mentioned his name. He had a follow-up question. Why isn't Brett Hundley drafted as a high upside backup? My quick answer to that is I'm not sure, but he really should be.
Why do you think so? I mean, just because of the offense that he's in?
I mean, the offense he's in, I know Joshua Lake is a big Brett Hundley fan. The type of quarterback he is, I'm always the type of guy that tends to gravitate towards the more athletic quarterbacks. And I think if he got a shot in that offense, it could be, you know, lights out from a fantasy perspective, just based on like his type of build and the players around him. So, and right now he's basically has no ADP wherever he looks. Recently just got picked in the SFB 480, so he had ADP of QB 52. I mean, we saw Scott Tolzien a couple years ago get a couple starts at offense. That was before Seneca Wallace got injured, and he was going to get a start. So I think if he gets a shot in that offense, he gets a chance to play. I could see him putting up some, you know, low-end QB1, maybe high-end QB2 numbers.
All right. Our next question is from Nick Medima at Nick Medima on Twitter. He says, who are your studs and streaming candidates for 2016? Don't worry, Sal. I'll handle the studs portion of this. Aaron Rodgers, Cam Newton, Andrew Luck, Russell Wilson, Drew Brees, Tom Brady. And now you go.
And don't forget Alex Smith. But yeah, so the streaming part of that, as most people know, one of my favorite draft strategies in two quarterback leagues is studs and streaming. You grab your QB1, the names Greg mentioned earlier, pair them up with a couple QB2, QB3 types. You can stream each week as your QB2 based on matchups. And we mentioned his name earlier, Pat Thorman. We mentioned his article, Strength of Schedule Analysis. That's where I tend to get most of my QB2 streaming pairing information from. I haven't fully dived into Pat's strength of streaming analysis yet, but after I got this Twitter question, I decided to take a look at the chart and check it out. So based on cost and matchups, one pairing I'm leaning towards right now is Tony Romo, Matthew Stafford. In our June 2 QB ADP, Romo is the QB 17. Try saying that a lot of few times because he's usually been a QB 1. He has an overall ADP of 79.4, and Matthew Stafford is right behind him at QB 18 with the exact same ADP. So no, these are two guys being drafted as mid to late QB 2s depending on your league size. But we've seen in the past they have QB1 potential in them. And so if you were to pair them both up, it's not going to cost you a whole lot. And if you stream them each week of the season in your QB2 slot, you're guaranteed no worse than what Pat calls a neutral matchup. And they have a ton of easy to super easy matchups basically all season from week 1 all the way to week 16. They also have different buys, so you're set there. So realistically, if everything hits for Romo and Stafford, they're fully healthy, they don't miss any games, they play to the potential we've seen them play, you could almost get QB1 production out of them, and they're only costing you mid-range QB2 prices.
Yeah, that's the type of combo that I would just draft as my late-round combo. I would just skip the whole stud part and just go to streaming those guys. That's how I play.
Yeah.
Our next question comes from @Santini73. He says, how do you evaluate keepers in a two quarterback league? And he then specifically references his 10 team league with the keepers that he's planning on taking. But Sal, in general, what's your approach to keeper formats, specifically two quarterback keepers?
Yeah, for sure. For me, it's rules always matter. Is it a one-year keeper rule, or can you keep your player every year? No, age, situation, talent are usually the three deciding factors when it comes to determining who I'm going to keep as my keepers. And I try to predict where they're going to be a year from now, 2 years, 3, 4 years from now, depending on how long I do get to keep them. Age tends to be a high priority for me in a keeper's situation. I know for the quarterbacks he mentioned, he had Ryan Tannehill, Matt Ryan, Tyrod Taylor, Teddy Bridgewater. We don't know the specifics of his rules, but just based on those four guys, Tyrod Taylor, leaps out to me the most based on age and talent.
Yeah, for me, the fewer keepers you're allowed to have, the more I care about just straight talent and the less I care about price. So if you can only keep one guy or two guys, I just probably want to keep the best two players I have. If you can keep a lot more guys, I still want to keep those elite players, and I want to try to focus on getting as many elite commodities as I can. But once I have more keeper spots, then that's when I'll start to consider, keeping guys who are not quite as, appealing from a talent or situation standpoint. But because the cost is so low, I want to keep them. And especially if they're young, that matters, like you said. Looking at the guys that he's got here, he lists Tannehill as a round 18 pick. Matt Ryan is a round 7 pick. Tyrod Taylor is a round 18. Bridgewater in round 12. Sproles in 11. Rawls in round 18. It looks like if you picked up a player off waivers, you get to keep them in the last round. Ryan Matthews round 9. Spencer Ware last round. Doug Baldwin last round. DeSean Jackson round 5. Devontae Parker round 8. Rashad Perriman round 8. Delanie Walker round 10. Gates round 17. Austin Seferian-Jenkins round 14. None of these really scream out to me as huge values, so I'd probably just try to keep the best players. Now, with that said, I mean, I also, when it comes to keepers, tend to prioritize wide receivers over all else. Just like when you're playing Dynasty, you want the guys who are at the least risk of losing their jobs or getting hurt, and generally that tends to be wideouts. So for me, even though Doug Baldwin isn't necessarily a young player, the fact that he's in a high-powered offense in the last round, I think that's a good keeper. Whereas, like, for comparison, DeSean Jackson in the 5th round, like, no way am I making him one of my keepers. Are there any of these guys that stand out to you, Sal?
Yeah, Doug Baldwin at that keeper value, I guess we'll say, and the potential that he has to be, like, a wide receiver 1 in fantasy this year, it's kind of a no-brainer for me. And I think Tyrod Taylor's value, too, I mentioned earlier. Those would be the two guys, if he could only pick 2, would be the 2 I would target. But I also like Devontae Parker, but I'm not sure. I think that might be what his draft cost is in keeper dynasty leagues. I'm not too sure at the moment. But he's another guy that stands out if you don't want to keep a quarterback and, like you mentioned, the receiver route.
Yeah, I mean, in general, looking at this list, I think the guys that are keepable in the last round, Baldwin, Taylor, Tannehill, and Rawls, are probably the most appealing just because it's based on price. So if you have a lot of keeper spots to burn, I would just keep those 4 guys and save all your early picks to try and load up on elite talents or whoever's left, you know, in that elite tier.
So, I'll take the next one here. I'll give you a little bit of a breather room. This one comes from Skinny Elvis. We kind of talked about it earlier, the Eagles situation, Bradford, Chase Daniel. So he asked, where do we have the Eagles quarterbacks ranked? And then he made a comment just saying, wouldn't surprise me to see Bradford bench hurt sometime this year, which complicates things. I'll just go off quickly. I kind of have them all ranked the same. Bradford, QB 33, Daniel right behind him at QB 34, Carson Wentz at QB 37. And like I said, Bradford's a starter right now, but no, who knows how long that'll last for. If you can get Chase Daniel later on in the draft and he becomes the QB 1, you just basically got yourself a cheap quarterback to start all year long. And we've kind of heard lately the reports on Carson Wentz might be kind of a redshirt year for him, or at least inactive start season. So I'm probably going to drop him down a bit in my rankings after hearing that. But no, I kind of view them all as, like, depending on your league size, late QB2s, early QB3s.
Yeah, it's a situation that I'm just avoiding for the most part. I like to lock up my quarterback. I am a late-round quarterback guy, but I like to lock up my quarterbacks a little sooner, and that is the type of situation that I'll just stay away from because I don't like having unknowns at that position. I take after Josh in that way where even if I'm drafting guys who are low-priced, I still want to feel comfortable with their situation. And in terms of the Philadelphia Eagles, I don't feel comfortable with any of those guys. I think Bradford is the safest, and that's why his ADP is the highest. But I haven't drafted Bradford once this season, and that's probably not going to change unless something drastic in the preseason crops up.
I mean, isn't it kind of crazy at this point last year, Sam Bradford was going in the 4th round of some 2 quarterback drafts?
Chip Kelly, man.
Ooh.
Yep.
Speaking of Chip Kelly, it's a good segue to our next question.
Go for it.
All right, so this one comes from our good friend Scott Barrett, writer for Pro Football Focus Fantasy. You can find him on Twitter at DudeFantasyBro/AlexSmithHater.
Great handle, bad brand.
His question is, as your QB3, QB4, and a 2 QB league, would you rather have one of these 3 combinations? So he lists off Blaine Gabbert, Colin Kaepernick, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Geno Smith, or Ryan Fitzpatrick, Blaine Gabbert combination. So it seems like basically he's asking us, do you want to lock up the Niners quarterback, the Jets quarterback, or try and guess which one will be which and get a combination of the 2? So how do you feel about these 3 situations, Greg?
It depends for me. If I want to count on one of these guys as my QB2 or like a kind of a surefire QB3, I'll go for the handcuff. I'll take Fitzpatrick and Geno. If I have, 2 very solid quarterbacks for my QB1 and QB2 spots, I would probably rather gamble on Gabbert and Fitzpatrick as a pair, guessing that both of those guys are going to be the starters. I'm a little disappointed that Geno and Kaepernick wasn't an option here, just saying. What do you think, Sal?
I mean, I think if you want to play it the safe route and be guaranteed at least one quarterback, you're going to just have to pick and choose which one of those combinations you like better between the Niners quarterback and the Jets quarterback. I think they both have appealing options with Blaine Gabbert. You know, we have him in the Chip Kelly offense. TJ Calkins wrote a really awesome in-depth passing offense breakdown looking at what Chip Kelly's impact could be on the Niners offense. And Blaine Gabbert's someone that's going basically – no, sometimes undrafted, but usually as a late QB3 in two quarterback leagues, and he's someone we saw last year. Out of the 8 games he started as a Niner, 7 he finished as a top 20 fantasy quarterback. So it might not be high upside, but at least it's steady productive value that you can get out of Blaine Gabbert. And a lot of people just hear the name Blaine Gabbert and just run screaming for the doors. So I think you can make a case for, I know, the Gabbert-Kaepernick combination. I think you can also make a case for the Fitzpatrick-Geno combination. I know we've seen Fitzpatrick last year in the Chain Gailey offense. We know how he can produce. We know they have Eric Decker and Brandon Marshall still around. Matt Forte is going to be catching balls. No, Jason Morrow has another year of season. So you can see, you know, Geno also being a good option if he's a starter. So I think those two are the safer. But if you, you know, you mentioned your roster construction, if you already have two solid quarterbacks and you want to kind of try and hit on some upside and, you know, basically hit sevens on both, the Fitz and Gabby has the most upside.
Yeah, I think that if I had to choose between just picking one of the teams, I'd definitely err on the side of the Jets, if only because I like their offensive weapons more. Like having Eric Decker, having Brandon Marshall is a lot better than what the Niners have to deal with. And we've seen Fitzpatrick, you know, kind of, we saw him excel last year, and we saw Geno Smith in his one game last year put up a really nice performance as well. Whereas with Gabbert and Kaepernick, the weapons they have, the fact that it's a new coach and a new system, there are more concerns there for sure. I do like that both of them are a little more mobile. I'm not shying away from the Niners as late round quarterback options. I actually took both of them in the Scott Fishbowl for what it's worth. So I think there's value to be had there in both cases. But yeah, I agree that if you're looking for upside, you should just try to pick the who you think is going to be the winner of the job in both teams and go with that pair. That does it on the Twitter question, Sal.
Yeah, good job, team. We had some really good Twitter questions this week. I mean, we always do, but this week I actually got to read all of them since I'm involved in the podcast.
Yep. Well, Sal, I definitely want to thank you for guesting on this episode. We appreciate your time. I know it's not always as easy for you to come on the podcast. Josh is actually out this week because he's going to be on the Fake Pigskin podcast. You should definitely check that out and hear what he has to say there. Any parting thoughts here before we wrap things up, Sal?
I know. I just want to thank Will Carroll again for guesting, though. It's at InjuryExpert on Twitter. You can read his work on FanDuel.com. I believe they have an NFL Insider section. One thing I want to say, you know, we mentioned the Scott Fishbowl earlier. It's kind of wrapping up. Most of the drafts are over. I might actually give Scott Fish, who created the whole thing, a chance to take a nap and get some rest. So before I go, I want to thank Scott for everything he's done with the Scott Fishbowl. We've been trying to find ways to give back to Scott and his philanthropic side, because he does tend to run a lot of fantasy cares leagues and just tries to raise money for Toys for Tots. So we created an SFB 480 t-shirt for anybody that's interested. Proceeds from that will go to Toys for Tots. You can get your own shirt at booster.com/SFB480. Looking at the tracker, we've raised $360 so far for Toys for Tots. So great job all around, everybody that's decided to get a shirt and donate to the cause.
Yeah, very cool. Let's get that number higher, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Sal, thanks again for coming on. If you want to get in touch with Sal, you can find him at Twitter at 2QBFFB. You can find me on Twitter at Greg Sauce. You can find the site at Twitter at 2QBs, and you got to spell that out, TWOQBS. That's going to be a recurring theme for the next things I'm about to plug, like our website, 2QBs.com, Facebook.com/2QBsDOTCOM. You can find us on Instagram as well. And if you want to email us, 2QBs@gmail.com. Thank y'all for listening. We'll catch you next time. We're out of here.